Supervisor. Exactly, that's an understatement. Shoulders droop, accompanied by a deep exhale, venting completed. Employee. I'll go get the sales report now and get you the report before your meeting this afternoon. Presumptive statement. Supervisor. Okay, see what you can do. Anger, resolution. A closer look at how the big three work to break the anger cycle. Empathic statements. In breaking the anger cycle, empathic statements are invaluable. When an angry person first hears an empathic statement, it can be surprising and confusing. When not expected, it can initially cause suspicion, but when sustained, it is difficult not to appreciate the concern it represents. Empathy thus quickly leads to trust. The more you can empathize, the more you can get immediate feedback on what a person is thinking about what you are saying to them. As a consequence, you can modify what you are saying and doing if you see your initial approach is not working. The question is, how do you do this? How do you empathize effectively? How do you find out what other people are feeling? All you have to go on is observing. 1. What they say. 2. How they say it. And 3. What they do. If you want to move an angry person toward a resolution, detecting their emotional state is the first step. When you can sense their emotion, you can then use this to move them in the direction you want them to take. The trick to spotting a person's feelings is to pay close attention to verbal and nonverbal changes in that individual in response to external events. If you say, "How are you?" and the corners of the person's mouth turn down and their voice tone goes flat, then you might detect that all is not well. The better you are at spotting changes in verbal and nonverbal cues, the greater your potential ability at empathizing. Watch for small changes on the face. Listen for tension in the voice and emphasis on specific words. Listen for emotional words. To avoid getting swamped by another person's emotions, learn to dip in and out of the association that makes you feel what they do. Go in, test the temperature, and then get out to a place where you can think more rationally. Unless you are sure, it can be a good idea to reflect back on the other person what you are sensing of their feelings, to check that you have it right. After all, the only individual who can confirm empathy is the person whose emotions are being sensed. Reflecting back has an effect, typically leading the other person to appreciate that you really care about them and hence increasing their trust in you. To people who are not angry, empathic statements might seem patronizing, but this is not the case for angry people for 2 reasons. First, the fight or flight response is engaged, and angry people cannot logically process information. In this case, empathic statements fall within the human baseline, and if properly constructed, will not be detected by the angry person. Second, people naturally think that others should listen to them and be sympathetic, particularly when they are angry. The key to constructing effective empathic statements is to identify the underlying reason for the anger. Simply saying, "So you're angry," is an empathic statement, but it is stating the obvious and could sound patronizing, which would add more fuel to an already angry person. I remember a time early in my FBI career when I was required to travel extensively. We had 3 children at the time, a baby and 2 toddlers. On one particular trip, I was gone for 2 weeks. When I opened the front door and announced that I was home, I expected a warm hug and a kiss from my wife. That didn't happen. Instead, she greeted me with, "It's about time you got home. I'm going crazy because you haven't been here to help me with the kids." I could have used the simple empathic statement, "So you're angry," but that would not have gone over well. Instead, I used a sophisticated empathic statement that addressed the root cause of her anger. I said, "You feel overwhelmed because I haven't been home to help you with the kids." I struck a sensitive chord. She vented. "I usually go out every Wednesday night with my friends to take a break from the kids and talk to some adults for a change." I could have used a simple empathic statement such as, "You miss going out with your friends," but again, this would not have played out well. Instead, I used a sophisticated empathic statement that addressed the root cause of her anger. I said, "You value the time you spend with your friends because it gives you a chance to take a break from the kids. Anger is just a symptom of an underlying problem." Empathic statements should target the underlying problem, Exposing the real cause of the anger will promote venting, which can be controlled by constructing effective empathic statements. Venting. Venting is a critical component of breaking the anger cycle because it reduces frustration. Empathic statements portray the target of the anger as non-threatening, which reduces the impact of the angry person's fight-or-flight response. Once angry people vent their frustrations, they become more open to solutions because they think more clearly when they are less angry. Venting is not a singular event, but rather a series of events. The initial venting is typically the strongest. This allows angry people to burn off most of their anger at the onset of the exchange. Subsequent venting becomes increasingly less intense, unless fuel is added to reignite the anger. A natural pause occurs after each venting event. During this pause, you should construct an empathic statement. Since empathic statements encourage venting, the angry person will likely continue venting, although with less intensity. After the next natural pause, you should construct another empathic statement. You should continue constructing empathic statements until the other person's anger is spent. Sighs, long exhales, slumping shoulders, and downward glances signal spent anger. At this juncture, you should introduce the presumptive statement. Presumptive statements. Presumptive statements direct angry people to take a course of action that leads toward conflict resolution. Presumptive statements are constructed in such a fashion that angry people have difficulty not following the directed course of action. Constructing presumptive statements requires practiced critical listening skills. The presumptive statement turns the force of the anger toward a resolution that is acceptable for both parties. Let's return to my awkward homecoming discussed previously. After a series of empathic statements, my wife's anger burned off. She let out a great sigh and her shoulders slumped. Her anger was spent. Now was the time to present a presumptive statement to direct her to take a course of action that would bring a resolution. I constructed the following presumptive statement. Why don't I gather the kids up and take them to my mom's house and we'll go out to a nice restaurant? You deserve it. My wife would have had a difficult time not following the course of action I presented. If she rejected my suggested course of action, she would have to admit that she didn't deserve to go to a nice restaurant, that she didn't feel overwhelmed, and that she didn't need a break from the kids, which are the very things she expressed as she vented her anger. Using this technique, I effectively resolved a situation that could have easily escalated into a major domestic dispute, which would have left us both angry and frustrated. If an angry person rejects the presumptive statement, you should begin the breaking of the anger cycle again with a new empathic statement. If my wife had rejected my suggested course of action, our conversation might have gone something like this. Me. Why don't I gather the kids up and take them to my mom's house and we'll go out to a nice restaurant? You deserve it. Presumptive statement. My wife. You're not getting off that easy, mister. Rejection of the presumptive statement. Me. So you think one night out is not enough to make up for the work you did while I was gone? Empathic statement, re-entering, breaking the anger cycle. Rejection of the presumptive statement typically indicates that the person has not completely vented his or her anger. Re-entering, breaking the anger cycle allows the person to vent any residual anger. Some people have deep-seated anger issues that may never be resolved. In these cases, the best course of action you could offer is to agree to disagree, or you could both agree not to bring the sensitive topic up again. These possible resolutions set boundaries for your relationships, not abruptly end them. The anger cycle can be used in virtually all situations when you are confronted by angry people. The following exchange between a customs office and a foreign visitor illustrates the use of the anger cycle to resolve a dispute. Customs officer. Ma'am, you can't bring dirt into this country. Visitor. It is sacred dirt from a holy place. I will not give it up. Customs officer. So, you don't want to give up the dirt because it is special to you? Empathic statement. Visitor. Of course, it's special. It's blessed ground. It keeps evil spirits away. It protects me from illness. I will not give it up, and you can't make me. Venting. Customs officer. This dirt fends off evil spirits and keeps you healthy. Empathic statement. Visitor. I haven't been sick even once since I got the dirt. I really need it. Venting. Customs officer. Staying healthy means a lot to you. Empathic statement. Visitor. Yes, it does. A sigh accompanied by a shoulder drop. Customs officer. Let's work together to come up with a solution to this problem. Presumptive statement. Would you like that? The visitor cannot say no without appearing unreasonable. Visitor. Of course. Customs officer. The regulation states that you cannot bring dirt into the country because the microbes in the dirt could infest crops, provides an explanation. I'm sure you don't want to be responsible for making millions of people sick, do you? Presumptive statement. The visitor cannot say yes without appearing unreasonable. Customs officer. Give me the dirt and you will be able to begin your visit to the United States. Visitor. If I have to, okay. Voluntary compliance. Re-entering the anger cycle. In the event the visitor remained angry and did not voluntarily give up the dirt, the customs officer would re-enter the anger cycle in an attempt to break it. The following exchange demonstrates re-entry into the cycle. Customs officer. Give me the dirt and you will be able to begin your visit to the United States. Visitor. No, my dirt isn't contaminated. I have to keep it. Customs officer. You are pretty passionate about keeping your dirt. Empathic statement. Visitor. I want my dirt. Can I at least keep a teaspoonful? Movement toward voluntary compliance. Customs officer. You are trying to figure out a way to get at least some of your dirt into the country. Empathic statement. Visitor. Yes, of course. Can I keep at least a teaspoon? That surely won't hurt anything. Movement toward voluntary compliance. Customs officer. The smallest amount of dirt can do great harm to the crops. Provides an explanation. Give me the dirt and you will be able to begin your visit to the United States. Presumptive statement. Visitor. All right, if I have to, I'll give it to you. I really don't want to do this. Voluntary compliance. In the event that re-entering the anger cycle does not produce voluntary compliance, the customs officer should develop two options and then allow the angry person to choose one of the options. Giving angry people two options to choose from creates the illusion that they're in control. The following exchange illustrates the you choose technique. Visitor. I refuse to give up my dirt. Customs officer. You seem pretty adamant about keeping your dirt. Empathic statement. The regulation states that you can't bring dirt into the country. You're going to have to make a decision. The first option is to give up your dirt and enter the country. The second option is to keep your dirt and not be allowed to enter the country. Presents two options. It's your decision. What happens from this point forward is up to you. Choose the option you prefer, creating the illusion that the visitor is in control. Visitor. I have no real choice because I want to enter the country. You can have the dirt. Voluntary compliance. Customs officer. You made the right decision. Welcome to America. In each of these scenarios, the officer maintained the illusion that the visitor was in control of the situation, but in reality, the officer directed the visitor one step at a time toward voluntary compliance. Some people feel they relinquish their authority when they use compliance techniques that subtly influence rather than intimidate. Gaining voluntary compliance through breaking the anger cycle not only enhances your authority, but also reduces the probability that the contact will go awry, and the angry person will just get madder and less compliant. By your breaking the anger cycle, there is a good chance the angry person will go along with the decision you wanted them to make and, at the same time, feel you treated them with respect. One couldn't hope for a better outcome to an angry confrontation. When relationships go south even after you've tried to save them. If you utilize the tools described in this book to establish and maintain healthy, happy relationships, you will almost always be successful. But what if, even after your best efforts, a short or long-term relationship goes bad? What then? Particularly with long-term interactions, where a significant amount of time and commitment has already been invested in the relationship, one would hope relationships would not be casually discarded at the first signs of distress. And in fact, they usually aren't. Most individuals enter into marriages and other forms of long-term relationships with the intention of staying in them. Yet there are times when even well-intentioned and responsible individuals find it difficult, if not impossible, to remain in a long-term relationship. Why? There are many reasons, but some of the most common include a divergence of interests, Individuals who might have shared the same outlook and career paths in their 20s may have different perspectives 30 years later. A new career or life focus can weigh heavily on a long-term relationship if both parties are not seeing eye to eye on the changes involved. The empty nest syndrome. When children leave the nest, one or both of the parents sometimes choose the same option. The need for more freedom. Couples who have been together for a long time, particularly if they married young, sometimes feel trapped and yearn for the freedom they see their single friends enjoying. This is a classic case of the grass is greener syndrome. Married people yearn for the freedom that single people have, and single people yearn for the commitment that married people enjoy. The need for change. Ever wonder why people in their late 60s and 70s opt to end long-term relationships? Sometimes it is simply the recognition that one doesn't live forever and that if one desires the chance to experience a different lifestyle, the window of opportunity is closing fast. Changes in personality in one or both partners. Our personalities are not static or set in stone by the time we are adolescents. We change over time. And if these changes drive people apart, they usually end up parting. Third, party disruptions. Behavioral scientists have long debated the issue of whether humans are naturally monogamous. While they continue to argue, long-term relationships continue to crumble due to infidelity and partner replacement with a new love interest. Boredom. Too much of the same thing can create boredom, an accelerant for relationship breakdowns, which can make once exciting interactions seem mundane and unsatisfying. Emerging incompatibilities. As relationships develop, so do the persons in the relationship. This can lead to problems. Should one party to the relationship develop behaviors unacceptable to the other? For example, one partner in a relationship might start drinking or gambling too much or show less interest in sex or become more reclusive, even start snoring, to the dismay of their light sleeping mate. The good news is that many, if not all, of these problems can be overcome through mutual effort or counseling if the people involved are committed to staying together and are willing to do what it takes to repair the relationship and make it whole. Even the best of friends can have the worst of arguments. Good relationships, short or long term, take effort to bloom. Like the gardener who wants his plants and trees to fully blossom, you must nurture relationships with care, patience, and loving understanding if you want them to flower. Relationships can't be left to die at the first sign of blight. You need to be convinced that you've done as much as you can to save a relationship before you consider ending it. In case of divorce, break glass. I was once given a wonderful piece of advice that I pass on to young couples whenever I can. When relationships are still new, vibrant, and full of love, write letters to each other. Pour your hearts out and go into great detail about what you like and admire about the other person. But don't share the letters. Instead, place them in separate sealed envelopes with your partner's name on the front. Then, place the letters in a box, which you'll want to store in a safe place. In the event the relationship goes sour, you can give each other the letters and read them. This emotional reminder may be enough to recharge the feelings of love and jumpstart a new era of togetherness. The letters can also be used as an emotional icebreaker to motivate you to resolve any major issues where you are at an impasse and need something to get you and your partner back on track towards solving your problems. One man I mentioned this idea to actually made a wooden container with a glass front similar to a fire alarm box found in many buildings. He then affixed a little metal hammer to the box with a metal chain. The sign on the box read, "In case of divorce, break glass." The letters in the box served as a constant reminder to the couple of the reasons they liked and admired each other when they first fell in love. In the middle of a fight or escalating disagreement, either one of them could comment, "Is it time to break the glass?" This not-so-subtle reminder quickly de-escalated the fight or disagreement and helped the couple resolve their conflict successfully. Chapter 8. The Perils and Promise of Relationships in a Digital World. Online, everyone can be who they want to be. It only gets tricky when you meet them in the real world. Toki.com. This is a true story. A love story of sorts, one that could only happen in our digital age. It involves a then 68-year-old professor and a Czech bikini model. This particular academician was not lacking in brain power. He worked as a theoretical particle physicist at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where he had been employed for 3 decades. The professor, still lonely after his recent divorce, visited some online dating sites, where he connected with the Czech beauty. After a flurry of emails, chat room sessions, and instant messages, it became obvious to the professor that the stunning model wanted to give up her career and marry him. It never seemed to cross his mind that the woman on the internet might have been an imposter, or why a young, attractive model would choose him as a husband. Sadly, he found out why the hard way. After many unsuccessful attempts by the professor to speak with the young woman on the phone, she agreed to go from virtual reality to real life. All the professor had to do was fly down to Bolivia, where she was currently working, and meet her. This he readily agreed to do. The rest of the story is almost too painful to relate. Upon arriving late in Bolivia due to a ticketing problem, the professor discovered that his girlfriend had already left. However, she told him not to worry. She would send him a ticket to Brussels, Belgium, where he could join her while she did a photo shoot. Her only request was to bring along a bag that she had left behind in Bolivia. At the Buenos Aires airport, the bag was searched. Hidden inside were 1,980 grams of cocaine. He did end up being charged for drug smuggling, but fortunately for him, he received a very light sentence. And what was the real Czech bikini model's reaction to all this? Fear over her name being associated with drug smuggling and sympathy for her academic suitor, who, of course, she had never met on the internet or anywhere else. According to Maxine Swan, a reporter who did an elaborate story on the incident for the New York Times, the professor reported that he was a month into his prison stay before his fellow prisoners managed to convince him that the woman he thought he'd been in touch with all this time had probably been a man impersonating her. Based on this story, you might think I recommend abstaining from using the digital world to meet people and make friends. However, nothing could be further from the truth. As long as you know how to tell the friends from the frauds, which this chapter will show you, the online landscape offers some distinct advantages. The internet is introvert-friendly. Introverts disclose more information on social networks than they do in face-to-face encounters. This is because the internet format allows introverts sufficient time to formulate meaningful responses. Introverts also experience difficulty initiating conversations, especially with strangers. Social networks eliminate this added social pressure. Social networks also allow introverts to express themselves without constantly being interrupted by extroverts. Finally, introverts are more willing to say what they really believe, not having to worry about the direct exposure to negative feedback that can occur in face-to-face communication. Ease of finding common ground. If ever there was a chance for the law of similarity, Chapter 4, to operate, it would be on the internet. When it comes to finding common ground with individuals possessing similar interests, the digital world provides the perfect environment for matchups. Want to find fellow stamp collectors? There's an internet group for that. Interested in people who exhibit antique automobiles? There's an internet group for that. Looking for that special group of sports fanatics who also volunteer at animal shelters and eat organic apples from the state of Washington? There's an internet group for that. Well, maybe. The point is that with millions of people on the internet and thousands of chat rooms and special interest groups devoted to almost any activity, real or imaginable, the chance to develop friendships with people sharing similar interests is never more than a click away. Numbers. If you're looking for a friend with specific qualifications and interests, where would you rather look? In a bar or other public place that might hold 100 people, or on the internet, where tens of millions of people await to be clicked on? The sheer number of people that go online increases your chances of finding persons of interest who best fit your particular needs. Less chance of being embarrassed. Anonymity and the ability to start and end relationships with a click of a mouse makes the online user much less likely to face the humiliation and embarrassment that comes with face-to-face disapproval or outright rejection. Of course, should an online user post information and pictures of a questionable nature, the chance of embarrassment definitely is increased, as has been the case with numerous high-profile politicians and celebrities over the years. The ability to pre-qualify potential friends. Particularly on dating sites, individuals looking for partners have the opportunity to describe what they want in a potential respondent. Of course, not all people reading the qualifications abide by them. Many individuals will contact you on the internet even when they do not possess the qualifications you are looking for. Still, screening mechanisms on certain online sites can be beneficial in limiting the number of people who contact you. The opportunity to check people out. The internet is information rich. It provides a wealth of information for those people who know how to get it or are interested in learning more about something or somebody. The internet should be seen as a tool to learn more about the people you are considering to develop relationships with, whether that person is someone you meet face to face or online. Obviously, this information search is more important for potential online friends because you don't have the advantage of information gathering through verbal and nonverbal cues available in real-life interactions. There is simply no denying that the advent of person-to-person online communication has dramatically altered the landscape of seeking friends and building relationships. As this form of digital interaction continues to grow in popularity, it will have an even greater impact on the way people develop relationships in the years to come. What does all this mean for you? To paraphrase Charles Dickens, it can be the best of times, it can be the worst of times. When employed correctly and with appropriate safeguards, establishing friendships in the digital world can be a rewarding and fruitful experience. However, plunging headlong into internet relationships without proper attention to the potential risks involved is a surefire recipe for disaster. Before you fire up your laptop or reach for your smartphone, here are some important things to keep in mind. Caution. Immortality ahead. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, chat rooms, special interest groups, email, blogs, internet search engines, dating sites, a literal cornucopia of opportunities to search for and meet people who could end up being friends or even lifelong partners. But be afraid, or to paraphrase the famous Jaws trailer, be very afraid of the potential price you pay whenever you go on the internet. Anything you say, anywhere you visit, any pictures you post, even your emails and instant messages can gain instant internet immortality, leaving you with a cyber footprint, which, unlike a footprint in the sand, is not easily washed away. Increasingly, prospective employers, potential lovers, would-be stalkers, businesses, and even government agencies are using your cyber activities to learn more about you and make decisions about how they will treat you, even if the information they use is decades old. Please keep in mind that what you post is who you are forever. Whenever you sit down at the computer and sign on to the internet, always keep this sentence in mind. Would I be embarrassed if what I am about to do would suddenly appear on the front page of my local newspaper tomorrow, in a month, or in 10 years? If the answer is yes, or maybe, stop and think before you hit the send button or enter key. It just might save you heartache and disappointment tomorrow and down the road. Learn and use proper digital etiquette when visiting cyberspace. Technology is evolving so quickly that social norms for using things like computers and smartphones don't always keep pace. Nevertheless, there are some general guidelines that, if followed, should make online experiences safer and more enjoyable for you and those around you. It will also increase your chances for making friends, rather than enemies, both online and in the immediate vicinity where you are texting, talking, or searching. Smartphones. In a Florida movie theater, a man was shot to death for using his smartphone after the house lights were dimmed. Chances are you won't experience a similar fate should you choose to text or talk in an inappropriate manner or place. However, there are simple guidelines you'll want to follow to protect yourself and your information from harm. 1. All mobile communication devices should be silenced in any public or private location where a ringtone would be distracting and/or inappropriate. All mobile communication device users should refrain from speaking on their phones in any public or private location where vocalizations would be distracting and/or inappropriate. Example, I didn't go out for a relaxing meal at a nice restaurant to hear your long-winded discourse about problems at home or work. 3. Smartphones can be hacked. Pictures and other information you would not want to see reprinted in your local newspaper would best be removed from the device. 4. Most cell phone bills provide a detailed history of calls to and from your device. If you would prefer that others not know who you called and who called you, it might be wise to keep this in mind. 5. Recording yourself doing things which, for lack of a better word, might be deemed inappropriate by others is probably not a good idea. Case in point, a woman from the United Kingdom picked up her boyfriend's smartphone and found images of him having sex with a dog. To make matters worse, it was her dog. How the woman reacted to this chain of events was not reported. 6. Sexting, particularly when pictures are included, is just not a good idea, even between husband and wife. These photos have a nasty way of suddenly appearing on social media websites, particularly if the husband and wife get divorced, and one or both of them are vindictive. 7. Don't let VR, virtual reality, trump RW, real-world relationships. Individuals vary in their tolerance of cell phone conversations and constantly checking social media, undertaken by someone they are with. Even if your companion, date, friend, or business associate, is more tech-savvy and tolerant than most, it is still considered inappropriate for you to be taking calls, checking messages, and frequently glancing over at your cell during your time together. In an earlier chapter on verbal communication, I pointed out how important it was to listen in a focused manner to the person you are talking with. It shows interest and respect, fostering a superior environment for making people like you and keeping friends. If you insist on seeing your phone as an umbilical cord in the presence of others, don't expect the birth of a good relationship. 8. Because cell phones retain their initial area code, regardless of where they are used, and further, because transmission of cell phone conversations is not always clear, it is important when you leave your number for a callback that you start with the area code and repeat the entire number twice. That way, you increase your chances that the recipient of your message will have the information necessary to get back to you. Electronic messages, email. 1. Emails fall somewhere between text messages and letters when it comes to how formal or informal your communication can be. Obviously, emails to prospective employers or important business contacts should be more reflective of a traditional letter, well thought out and grammatically sound. That being said, it is advisable to keep all emails free of the type of abbreviations normally used in texting, and check for spelling mistakes before transmitting your messages. 2. Carefully consider your screen name when using email communications. A screen name that might be acceptable for communications between friends could be wildly inappropriate if used when contacting prospective employers or your kid's school official. One of my colleagues who teaches human resource management in a business school showed me her inappropriate screen name Hall of Fame list, which included names actually used by her students in applying for jobs. Number 1 on the list was Lick Me Red. Number 3. Don't write email text in capital letters. It is considered to be the equivalent of shouting at someone in verbal interactions and is viewed as rude. 4. Never write an email when you are extremely angry or distraught. In an earlier chapter, I emphasized that people who are agitated in such a manner have difficulty thinking rationally. An email written during these times often reflects this damaged thought process. If you must write such a message, don't send it. Not immediately, anyway. Put it aside for several hours and then reread it when you have calmed down and you can think more rationally. Only then should you consider sending it, probably with significant revisions. Another good reason not to immediately send out an angry email is its potential to further escalate the situation. The problem might be resolved or go away within a few hours if left alone. A hasty, angry response effectively eliminates this possibility. 5. When you are ready to send an email, be sure to check to whom it is being sent. Many embarrassing incidents could have been avoided if the email sender had made sure his or her message was being sent to a specific person and not reply all. 6. An email can be forever, or at least linger in cyberspace for months, even years. Once an email is out there, it can take on a life of its own, reproduced, forwarded, archived. Each time you write an email, you should ask yourself, what if this email went public and stayed public for a significant period of time? Would I still send it? 7. Deleted emails can still be recovered for months after you have erased them. This is because many internet servers save deleted emails on their computers. The recovery of supposedly deleted emails has revealed sensitive information about or from individuals they thought was safely destroyed. Oftentimes, these persons discovered this unsettling news in open court. 8. Never open an email attachment unless you are sure you know who sent it and that they, in fact, were the senders. Email addresses are sometimes illegally accessed from a person's computer and then used to send messages containing viruses to everyone on that person's contact list. It appears that the message is legitimate because it is sent from the compromised person's computer. In general, it is best not to open any email attachments unless absolutely necessary. Protecting your computer with security programs that screen attachments, for example, Norton or McAfee, is advised. Otherwise, opening attachments on your computer is akin to having unprotected sex. Social sites: Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, etc. 1. Social sites vary in their filtering mechanisms, who can and cannot see your postings. Be sure you are familiar with these filters and use them appropriately. 2. Assume that anything you post on a social site can be accessed and reproduced for others to see. Further, keep in mind that those college parties where you were photographed drinking and having a good old time might someday be accessed by a prospective employer, potential or actual spouse, or even your parents and in-laws. 3. As a general rule, it is wise to limit your digital footprint online. Excessive use of social sites enlarges that footprint and might cause problems down the road. 4. Be careful who you friend. Digital detectives. As you know by now, I am a frequent flyer. This time I approached the gate at the Nashville airport to see if I could fly standby on an earlier flight. But this story is not about me getting an upgrade. The gate clerks, a man and a woman, were intently examining a very expensive digital camera. I heard them comment to each other. There's no name on the camera or any other unique identifying information. We have to find out who this camera belongs to and give it back to them. I asked them what they were doing. In unison, they said, "We're the FBI agents of American Airlines." I told them I was a real FBI agent, although I was retired. I asked them how they could find the owner of the camera without any clues. The man explained that they would turn the camera on and look for clues in the pictures the owner took. I was intrigued as I saw them go through the process of solving the digital puzzle. As they shuffled through the date-stamped pictures, they gathered digital clues. The owner was a male of Hispanic descent. It appeared that he had spent 3 days in Las Vegas, probably on business, because there were no family pictures. He stayed at the Bellagio Hotel. They continued to scroll through the pictures. The woman high-fived the man and shrieked, "I found it!" She showed me the picture on the camera that was taken the previous week. The photo depicted a newer wood-frame house with blue siding. I saw the picture, but I didn't see what triggered their excitement. She pointed to the house and said, "Those kinds of houses are typically built on the East Coast in mid-Atlantic states." "Okay," I thought, "so what?" She then directed me to the barely visible for sale sign in the front yard. "Okay," I said, not sure of the significance of the sign. She used the camera's zoom feature to make the address and telephone number of the real estate agency clearly visible. The real estate office was in Columbia, South Carolina. I finally got it. I blurted out loud, "The owner of the camera was probably from Columbia, South Carolina, because people typically don't take pictures of houses for sale unless they are considering a purchase." The woman added, An earlier flight we boarded was headed to Columbia, South Carolina. She pulled up the passenger list, and fortunately, there were only a few Hispanic names listed. I had to board my flight, but I was confident that the FBI agents of American Airlines would locate the owner and return the camera. I was amazed by how easy it was to track the movements of the owner of the lost camera using a few abstract digital clues. I was even more amazed that they went the extra mile to return the lost camera. They said they returned many lost or forgotten electronic devices using similar methods. The point of the story is that, in a digital world, it's hard to remain anonymous. Keep this in mind the next time you post something on the internet or do something as benign as taking a digital photograph. Catfish or caviar? What you need to know before developing online relationships. The internet provides a fertile environment for growing friendships and even lifelong liaisons between individuals. This has led to the development of websites that facilitate the online dating process and make it easier for individuals interested in finding significant others to hook up. The people who own these websites claim great success in getting soulmates together, providing the mechanism through which people meet online and eventually establish long-term commitments in the real world. Using the internet to find Mr. or Ms. Right can be a rewarding experience. It can also be a living hell. How your experience turns out depends on many factors, most of which will be discussed here. Although no one can guarantee that your internet-generated relationships will be successful and trouble-free, there are some things you can do to increase your chances of experiencing positive outcomes and reducing negative ones when it comes to choosing friends and potential partners online. Love at first bite. The young man was a star Notre Dame football player who fell in love with a woman he met online. Then tragedy struck. His sweetheart died of leukemia. To make matters worse, she died on the same day the football player's grandmother passed away. The star player's twin tragedies became a national news item, but the story was soon eclipsed by an even bigger story. It turned out that the woman he loved didn't die after all, because she never lived in the first place. It turned out she was a person created in cyberspace by someone with a very sick sense of humor. And then there's the saga of Sana and Adnan Cleric. It seems the couple's married life was not going well, and so, unbeknownst to each other, each cleric assumed a fake screen name, Sweetie and Prince of Joy, respectively, and hit the online chat rooms complaining about their dismal marriage and searching for a new Mr. and Mrs. Right. It took some time and a lot of keystrokes, but at last, the two estranged partners found online individuals who seemed to resonate with their problems and provide the kind words so missing in their marriage. Sana and Adnan knew they had found the real loves of their lives. They agreed to meet their new partners at a prearranged time and place. On the big day, Sana and Adnan made excuses to each other about having to leave for appointments, each making sure their indiscretion would not be detected. They then set off to meet their online paramours, the perfect replacements for what they had back home. When they arrived at their rendezvous point, Sana and Adnan met their online lovers for the first time. It was not love at first sight. It turned out that Sana and Adnan had unknowingly been carrying on their online affair with each other. One might best leave it to ethicists and lawyers to decide if Sana and Adnan were being unfaithful, as it is difficult to imagine committing adultery with your own spouse. However, Sweetie and Prince of Joy were not pleased, and, at last report, were accusing each other of being unfaithful and filing for divorce. What do all these stories demonstrate? 1. Relationships developed over the internet can be as powerful as those developed in face-to-face interactions, and sometimes more so. 2. On the internet, things are not always as they appear. 3. If a world-class physicist can be duped over the internet, you probably can be too. 4. There are creepy, mean, sick people populating the internet just as they do in the real world. 5. Scams involving relationships on the internet are more common than most of us imagine. They have become so widespread, in fact, that a documentary film, MTV reality series, and feature film have been based on the problem. A word has even been coined, catfish, which, as internet attorney Perry Aftab says, refers to anybody who pretends to be someone who they're not on social media. It's done all the time. I've taken that expression one step further with catfish to also include the hackers who wish to steal your identity. 6. Because of the cloak of secrecy provided by the Internet, people will say things in cyberspace they would never say in a personal interaction. On the Internet, as in real life, if it's too good to be true, it probably is. Social networks can be hazardous. No communication posted to the Internet can be guaranteed to remain private. You must assume that your posts are permanent and public. 8. As in face-to-face communications, pretending to be someone you are not often leads to unpleasant outcomes. 9. There are things you can do to navigate the Internet more safely and effectively. Some suggestions are provided in the following pages. These suggestions are not only relevant for individuals seeking love on the Internet. They will be helpful for anyone looking for friends in cyberspace. Testing for veracity online and offline. Letting our teenagers roam freely on the Internet, especially my daughter, was a scary proposition for my wife and me. So, I taught them some techniques I used on suspects to determine their veracity. I did this to help protect them from both online and real-world predators. I offer these techniques to you for the same reason, to help you guard against deceptive on- and offline communications. The results of these seeming innocuous veracity tests are not absolute proof of deception, but they do provide you with strong indicators that someone might be lying or at least stretching the truth beyond acceptable limits. The well technique. When you ask someone a direct yes or no question, and they begin their answer with the well, there is a high probability of deception. It indicates that the person answering the question is about to give you an answer that they know you are not expecting. The following exchanges will clarify the well technique. Dad, did you finish your homework? Daughter, well, Dad, go to your room and finish your homework. Daughter, how did you know I didn't do my homework? Dad, I'm a dad. I know these things. The dad didn't need to wait for his daughter to finish her answer because he knew, by her use of well in response to his direct question, that she was about to give him an answer she knew he was not expecting. The daughter knew her dad was expecting a yes answer to the question, did you do your homework? In another example, I interviewed a person who I thought witnessed a murder. The person was in proximity to the crime scene, but he denied seeing the shooting. After giving me some evasive answers, I decided to test his veracity by asking him a direct yes or no question. Me. Did you see what happened? Witness. Well, from where I was, it was hard to see much of anything. It was dark, and it all happened so fast. I asked the witness a direct question to which he knew I expected a yes answer. Since he began his response with well, I knew he was about to give me an answer other than yes. I let the witness finish his response so as not to alert him to the technique. The well technique only works with direct yes or no questions. Beginning a response with well in answer to an open-ended question such as who will win the Super Bowl next year indicates the person is evaluating how to answer the question. You should allow others to finish their answers before responding so as not to alert them to this technique. Be advised that if the person you are talking to is aware of this technique, he or she will deliberately avoid using well. Get into the habit of asking people a direct yes or no question and listening for their response. Answering such a question with well, or not directly answering the question, is a strong indicator of deception, requiring additional probing. The land of is. When people choose not to answer yes or no, they go to the land of is. The land of is occupies the space between truth and deception. This murky area contains a labyrinth of half-truths, excuses, and suppositions. President Clinton's now famous statement to the grand jury inspired the concept of the land of is. To paraphrase what Clinton stated, it depends upon what the meaning of the word is. If is means is and never has been, that's one thing. If it means there is none, that was a completely true statement. Clinton cleverly took the prosecutor to the land of is to avoid directly answering the prosecutor's direct yes or no question. The following exchange between a mother and daughter demonstrates the land of is technique. Mom, your teacher called this afternoon and told me that she suspected you of cheating on an exam. Did you cheat on your exam? Daughter, I spent 2 hours a night studying. I study more than anybody I know. People who don't study are the people who have to cheat on exams. I study all the time. Don't accuse me of cheating. Mom, I'm not accusing you of cheating. Daughter, yes, you are. The mom asked her daughter a direct yes or no question. Her daughter chose not to respond with a simple yes or no answer, but instead took her mother to the land of is to avoid directly answering it. The daughter ended her response with an accusation, which put mom on the defensive. The topic was no longer about cheating, but about mom making unwarranted accusations. Mom could have prevented her daughter from going to the land of is by first recognizing that the technique was being used and then redirecting the conversation back to the initial topic of inquiry. For example, Mom, your teacher called this afternoon and told me that she suspected you of cheating on an exam. Did you cheat on your exam? Daughter, I spend 2 hours a night studying. I study more than anybody I know. People who don't study are the people who have to cheat on exams. I study all the time. Don't accuse me of cheating. Mom, I know you study hard and get good grades. That's not what I asked you. I asked you whether or not you cheated on your exam. Did you cheat on your exam? Redirecting the conversation back to the initial question forced her daughter to answer the question. Did you cheat on your exam? Her daughter must answer yes or no, or take her mother back to the land of is. Failure to answer a yes or no question with a yes or no answer is not conclusive proof of deception, but the probability of deception does increase significantly. If her daughter did not cheat on her exam, answering no would not be difficult. The truth is simple. The truth is direct. The truth is not complicated. Why should I believe you? When someone provides you with an answer to a question, simply ask them, why should I believe you? Honest people typically answer, because I am telling the truth or some derivation thereof. Truthful people simply convey information. They focus on accurately presenting facts. Conversely, liars try to convince people that what is being said is true. Their focus is not on accurately presenting facts, but rather on convincing listeners that the facts presented represent the truth. Since liars cannot rely on facts to establish their credibility, they tend to bolster their credibility to make their version of the facts appear believable. When people answer with other than, because I'm telling the truth or some derivation thereof, tell them that their response did not answer the question and repeat the question, why should I believe you? If they again do not respond with, because I am telling the truth or some derivation thereof, the probability of deception increases. The following exchange between a dad and his son demonstrates the why should I believe you technique. Dad, there was $10 on my dresser this morning. It's no longer there. Did you take money from my dresser for any reason? Son, no. Dad, son, I want to believe you, but I'm having a hard time. Tell me, why should I believe you? Son, I'm not a thief. Dad, I didn't ask you if you were a thief or not. I asked you why I should believe you. Why should I believe you? Son, because I didn't steal the money, I'm telling you the truth. Dad, I know you are, and I believe you. In this exchange, the son responded that he was not a thief. This response did not answer the question, why should I believe you? Dad gave his son a second chance by telling him that the question was not whether he was a thief, but rather, why should I believe you? This time, the son answered, because I didn't steal the money, I'm telling you the truth, which indicates the son was probably telling the truth. The fact that the son correctly answered the question, why should I believe you, does not mean he told the truth, but it does decrease the likelihood of deception. When you communicate with people, especially on the internet, by instant messaging, or by texting on a smartphone, use these simple, non-invasive techniques to test the person's veracity. These techniques are so subtle that the people you are communicating with will not even recognize that they are being tested for veracity. Although these techniques are only indicators of deception, not proof of deception, they do provide you with a strong line of defense against online predators. Detecting deception in online profiles. Most people do not accurately describe themselves in online profiles, especially dating profiles. Researchers Toma, Hancock, and Ellison surveyed 80 people who submitted online profiles to various dating websites. An astounding 81% of the online daters lied about one or more of their physical attributes, which included height, weight, and age. Women tended to lie about their weight, and men tended to lie about their height. Women whose weight scored further from the mean lied more about their degree of obesity. Likewise, men whose height scored further from the mean lied more about how tall they were. The survey respondents reported that they were more likely to lie about their photographs than in relationship information, such as marital status and the number of children they have. In a follow-up study by Hancock and Toma, they found that about one-third of the online photographs examined were not accurate. Women's photographs were judged as less accurate than men's photographs. Women were more likely to be older than they were portrayed in their photographs. Their photographs were more likely to be photoshopped or taken by professional photographers. Additionally, less attractive people were more likely to enhance their profile. The most interesting finding was that although people frequently lied in their online profiles, they attempted to keep their alterations within believable parameters. In the event, they met their correspondents in subsequent face-to-face meetings. The magnitude of deception in online profiles should not come as a big surprise. An online profile is the equivalent of a first date. Anyone who has been on a first date will remember putting his or her best foot forward, just as in a first job interview we wear our interview suit. Women dressed with great contemplation and took extra minutes to put on their makeup. Men ensured their clothes were color-coordinated and wrinkle-free. Conversations were rehearsed before any words were exchanged. Personality flaws and behavioral quirks were carefully camouflaged with polite talk and impeccable manners. The extra steps were taken to make the right first impression. Putting your best foot forward when meeting someone is not construed as deception, because the foot put forward still is recognizably yours, albeit an enhanced version. People who present themselves on the Internet should try to put a positive face on their profile, but remain within the bounds of truth when including a photograph and a description of who they are. Likewise, people who use the Internet to search for potential relationships should learn to take online profiles with a grain of salt, recognizing that the person they are scrutinizing is never going to appear more attractive or qualified than the picture and resume they post. Men and women feel the need to meet standards of beauty that society establishes, and which are reinforced by the media. People lie to bring themselves closer to the standard image in the hope of attracting a friend or a mate. People who believe they do not meet those standards feel less attractive and are less confident that they can attract and keep a partner without lying about who they really are and how they really look. This pattern will not change in the foreseeable future. To the contrary, it will most likely intensify as online dating and internet chat rooms become more popular and proliferate. Anyone who seeks relationships on the internet should be aware of the line that separates a best impression profile from a deceptive one. A deceptive online profile may attract a suitor or friend, but once the deception is discovered, trust, disappointment, and betrayal becomes the centerpiece of the relationship instead of excitement, hopes, and dreams. If you want to try internet relationship buildup, be honest in your online profile and be patient. The right relationship is worth the wait. How to reduce your chances of being hooked by a catfish. The flit of an eye, the turn of the head, or a slight change in voice pitch provides clues to a person's personality, sincerity, and veracity. As cited earlier in the book, our brains constantly monitor verbal and nonverbal cues to assess others, to see if they pose a potential threat. If the cues are friend signals, then the brain tends to ignore the behaviors. If the cues are foe signals, the brain initiates the fight-or-flight response, and we go shields up to protect ourselves against the threat or potential threat. Nonverbal and verbal cues can undergo dramatic changes, from second to second, and from one word to the next. Monitoring these changes can mean the difference between relationship happiness and relationship hell. People are comfortable using verbal and nonverbal cues to assess others and rely heavily on this method to protect themselves against initiating or continuing bad relationships. Internet relationships lack the cues necessary for people to make similar judgments. Emoticons help decode written communications, but they are not enough. Decoding an unseen person's personality, sincerity, and veracity requires additional skills when communicating on the Internet. People are poor judges of their Internet partners because the cues they rely on in face-to-face exchanges are